A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar.
That's the display department.
With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
You are just number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders Episode 21. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are talking about UFO. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England.
This is the second half of our discussion about UFO, and we mentioned last time that Gerry Anderson did not go back to doing supermarionation shows after he did UFO. He did, in fact, do a show in the 80s called Terrahawks, which was not actually supermarionation. It was a slightly different technique called supermacromation that involved latex hand puppets. So he did actually go back to the puppet theater type shows. We mentioned in the previous episode that there was a production break about two-thirds of the way through the production of UFO. And despite the fact that they only had one season in the whole series, it was done in two shots. The early stuff and the last little bit of it were actually quite different than how they fit together. In the very first episode of UFO, it was called Identified. They introduced Shadow and all these different characters and all these spectacularly high-tech vehicles and so on, and they introduced the UFOs. And at the beginning, they had never actually seen the aliens piloting these UFOs. They knew very little about them. And in that first episode, it was called Identified, and they captured and identified one of these aliens. And they found that they were in these very small crafts, which are the UFO, that can hold one or two individuals, and that's it. And the aliens were humanoid. In fact, they really basically looked human. They traveled in these ships in a way where they were immersed in liquid and breathing liquid, and this was how they could survive the extreme acceleration in the spaceships and so on. So you had these fairly impressive shots of this colored liquid draining out of the helmets and revealing the aliens within them. And the aliens basically appeared human, and it was revealed at the beginning that they were very long-lived because of their technology. And in order to have these long lives that they have, they needed to harvest organs that they could use for transplants. And the reason they were coming to Earth was that they were kidnapping people and harvesting organs from them. And the series started out with this very creepy sort of way that things were being done, that the aliens were doing this. And this, I think, was something that was supposed to set the tone of how the series would be a little more adult, a lot more adult in its themes than the earlier supermarionation shows that Gerry and Sylvia Anderson had done. Much later in the series, after the production break, we had an episode called The Cat with 10 Lives, and you started to see a lot of the inconsistencies of the early part of the series and the late part of the series in this episode. In particular, they introduced the idea that, well, maybe they were wrong about the aliens, and the aliens weren't humanoid, they just had these human bodies that they were controlling. And they were using the organs and entire people from Earth to have these people, these essentially humans, that they would use as tools, because the aliens themselves had no physical form, or had a physical form that couldn't interact and do the traveling and do the things that they needed them to do. So you started out with aliens harvesting organs, and you ended up with aliens controlling people. And in those later episodes, they had a lot of cases where these people would be walking around as normal humans, and then they were suddenly possessed by the aliens. So it was a very different type of villain that you had in the last third of the series.
It was creepy stuff that they set up, this very adult, creepy theme that the aliens were basically abducting people and harvesting them for organs to keep them to keep the aliens alive. And that's what was going on. And it was, you know, it was a very unpleasant start. We almost get an alien autopsy in the very first episode. We don't see a great deal, but it's, you know, it's that sort of stuff is going on. The liquid that the aliens travel in gives their skin this sort of greenish tint. We haven't got little green men, we've got quite big green men. That's all going on. And we've mentioned one of the characters, Peter Carlin, who was the original pilot of Sky One. And we find out early on that his sister was abducted in one of the very first UFO encounters. And of course, when they find out why the aliens are abducting people, he gets the realization that his sister is almost certainly dead and what's happened to her, which is, you know, quite unpleasant and shocking. The only problem is that, as Brian says, the inconsistencies creep in. We get other episodes during the 26 episodes where the alien plans don't seem to make sense. In particular, there's two episodes, an episode called Destruction and the final episode called The Long Sleep, where it would appear that the aliens are not after humans to harvest our organs. They just want to wipe us all out. There's a plan to release a nerve gas which will destroy all life on Earth. And I think the other one concerns huge explosive devices which would wipe out large parts of humanity, which just doesn't seem to make sense with the aliens', you know, need to keep themselves alive by stealing our organs.
Or even with the aliens' need to use humans as tools for traveling and doing these other things, it doesn't make sense to wipe out humanity in that case either.
No, it does. You know, it does seem odd. I think we have this problem as the series progresses that, you know, each episode has a different writer and a different director. I think, unfortunately, one of the problems was that the Andersons were very much concentrating on the look and feel and sound of the series, but there wasn't anybody sort of taking an overriding view of the plot. And, you know, saying, well, that doesn't make sense. We've got to stick to the original alien plan as discovered in the first episode.
It was definitely focused on the look from how the series was run. And there were some very interesting and distinctive things done with the look, for sure. Something else that came in is that they would have a lot dealing with people's work and their personal lives. So you would have things like Ed Straker, who is basically completely committed to Shadow and spending all of his time working for Shadow and running Shadow, and his marriage basically falls apart because of it. And there are issues that come in with his son later on, and there's some pretty dark stuff in how they're dealing with his life falling apart because he's so much of a workaholic working with Shadow. And there are a number of other characters with Lieutenant Ellis, for example. They have this whole thing with a love interest with her and someone else who is on Moonbase, and a whole variety of things with different kinds of conflicts that people were having between work and their lives, or just between making everything be stable in general.
Yeah, it's quite, I mean, this is quite interesting stuff. The good stuff comes with all this sort of relationships and family stuff as the episodes progress. As you say, Lieutenant Ellis is probably having an affair with one of the Interceptor pilots, and there's a big question about whether or not that influences her decisions to put the Interceptors into harm's way. So that's quite interesting. And Straker, as you say, I mean, he's this real driven character who's entirely committed to Shadow and his job of protecting the Earth. But in a couple of episodes, we get to see what that costs him, which is quite a lot.
And Paul Foster also had relationships going on with different people, and at times that came up as an issue and a concern as well. They had raised the possibility that people might be given different assignments to avoid having those kinds of relationships happening as well.
This is the good stuff, I think, in UFO. The way they dealt with the working relationships was quite effective. You do get the sense that they're having to move people around to avoid some of the conflicts. But Straker, he just can't avoid them. He's just absolutely dead set on his job. And the consequences for his personal life, we get to see. It's quite, you know, it has quite an impact on him. Although they're very well funded, Shadow are clearly very well funded. We do see Straker having to battle for his funding at various points through the series. That he has to meet with, I think, what's basically supposed to be representatives of the United Nations or something like that, and, you know, argue for funding for various projects for Shadow. And along the way, we get some very good episodes. We get good tension and drama along the way. We have an episode with one of the submarines which crashes, basically. In a way, it's a classic submarine on the bottom of the ocean in you know, will the rescuers get in time? It's a scenario we've seen in film and television before, but it's very well done here, and it's a good episode.
I think that was their strongest episode. Their better episodes were the ones where they dealt with little interpersonal things like that. There was also a very early episode that was quite good, where there was someone who was out on the surface of the moon in a spacesuit, and he was basically stuck there. An alien was also stuck there in his spacesuit, and they had to work together to survive in another classic sci-fi type story. But it was also done pretty well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the episode Survival. And as you say, it's a classic sci-fi plot of the two opposing sort of warriors having to work together to survive. It crops up in the movie Enemy Mine.
That's right. And the book Enemy Mine before that.
There are lots of very good episodes along the way as we're moving through the stuff. It's just a shame there isn't a slightly more consistent handling of what the aliens are up to. And also that we just keep getting the no consequences from episode to episode. The stuff they learn in one episode doesn't seem to influence their behavior in future episodes.
The other thing that was a little weak, in my opinion, was that you had these adult ideas and sort of interesting things that were going on that were definitely not for kids, but you had this fancy action adventure with all the model work and things that were very much in their Super Mario Nation tradition and almost seemed to be constructed like they were for kids. Getting those two elements to balance and to work well together was not always something that they achieved.
Yeah, it's a problem because, as you say, the kids were certainly drawn to the Gerry Anderson model work and the very exciting opening sequence. But then a lot of the stuff that's going on is much more adult. And in fact, of the 26 episodes, I think two of the 26 were not broadcast in the original run because they were thought to be just too racy. One of them concerned, I think, drug use, and the other concerns, how should we say, extramarital relationships, which, you know, was quite racy, I think.
Yes, I could see how they would have done that.
So they were dropped in the first run, but were later, I think, rebroadcast in repeats.
I tried to call you, Commander. I was told you were not available. Were they your instructions?
Yes.
I see. A very high-handed attitude. However, one more question. Is it true you ordered all three moon base interceptors to destroy certain items of space junk?
Correct.
Do you realize what you've done?
You tell me.
You've blatantly and openly defied the Commission and left Moon Base and the Earth defenseless.
It was my decision. I realized the implications.
You had better start packing, Straker. When the Commission hears about this, you're through.
Aren't you interested in hearing my reasons?
Oh, let's be kind. Let's put it down to a mental aberration, the strain of command. Get those interceptors back on Moon Base, Commander, while you can still give orders.
Sorry, Henderson.
Don't push your luck, Straker. If Moon Base reports
a UFO sighting, stick around. I'm expecting it.
We also get science fiction looking ahead to the future, which is always fun. So we have them sort of looking 10 years into the future. And of course, we always have this problem when we look back, when we're now looking back at something that has come to pass, so we can now sort of slightly smirk at some of their predictions. But there was some interesting stuff that they were predicting in 1970. I mean, in particular, another parallel with Star Trek, in that they predicted a very sort of integrated society, that it's very sort of, there's racial and sexual equality. So there are lots of different colours and creeds represented in shadow, and they all seem to have equal responsibilities and abilities, which I know some people have pointed out was quite unusual for British television at this time, where there were some other programmes on British television around 1970 which had a very sort of reprehensible view of race relations and sexual relations. So in that way, UFO was quite enlightened and looking forward.
Yes, it was. And I think as far as gender equality, I think they handled it better than the original Star Trek did, with characters like Virginia Lake being basically the second in command near the end of the series and so on.
Yeah. And as you say, Moonbase is run by, almost exclusively run by females, by women, which is good. And they predicted a very sort of affluent, smart society. You know, all the characters we see in their sort of civilian lives seem to live in very sort of smart houses and go to very smart parties and have these fabulous clothes. But of course, they also predicted some of the less pleasant aspects of society. So there's a big thing about conspiracies and secrecy, and also this sort of paranoia, this sort of fear of invasion.
Yeah, I guess there's something of a Cold War influence on that, that it was that sort of society of the ideas of fear and the like that were there. But in that aspect, the way they handled the secrecy and these different kinds of things and the sort of alien unknown threats, those were handled in a way that is really not very dated still, which is nice.
Yeah, it was good. And as you say, I mean, the Cold War one is a good comparison, actually. I hadn't thought of that. But you're right. There is that sort of fear of the others, which really played into Cold War paranoia. So that was very good.
There are many other series, some of which we've covered on British Invaders, where there were these elements of sort of Cold War fear and those types of things in it that are more obvious and more dated when we look at them now. Ones that come to mind are Blake 7 with its sort of Stalinist Federation as the big enemy, and Star Cops with the tension between the Russian character and the British characters.
Yeah, that's right, yes.
So they also focused a lot on predicting technology in UFO. There was a great deal of gadgetry and vehicles and technology of all sorts in this series. And they predicted some interesting things. They certainly were predicting cheap space flight. So you had a shuttle that could go to the moon and back that seemed to run almost every day. The moon was also large and focal, not surprising for something coming from 1969, 1970, around the time of the moon landing. They had a number of sort of research bases and little commercial bases all over the moon. So you had the big shadow base, and none of the civilian people were allowed to go anywhere near it. But you had, from time to time, the shadow personnel would go out to other sort of commercial and research bases to talk to people there and make sure they weren't interfering in anything.
As you say, they were filming this at the sort of just after the first moon landing, at the height of Apollo mania. And they must have thought that in 10 years' time, we would be nipping backwards and forwards to the moon fairly cheaply and quickly and easily.
That's right. And they also had some more terrestrial sort of minor gadgetry. They used computers a lot. And this was going back to another sort of common 60s idea that when computers became bigger and more sophisticated, they'd sort of be almost all-powerful or all-knowing. The computers in UFO were like Sid. They'd be able to predict where a UFO was coming, and it seemed to be mostly the computer that was doing that, not the sensors. And they had computer tests that people would take to determine if, for example, the type of relationship that two people had was okay on moon base. Was it okay to have this couple, or would it cause them problems and they had to transfer one of them to some other shadow installation? This was a big idea that they were testing people with computers and running scenarios with computers and doing all of these things, and whatever the answer was right, and the computer was sort of the judge and authority. And they would do all these little gadgets. They had wireless phones. That was a fairly accurate prediction. On Straker's desk in Shadow, he had three sleek-looking phones next to him on one little panel, as if for three different phone lines, and they were different colored phones. And there were no wires attached to them. He just picked them up off the base and talked to them. They had these things involving mind control with the aliens and things like that coming up, and drugs being involved there. They also had amnesia drugs, so whenever someone found out about Shadow, they would administer a drug and the person would conveniently forget about it. That was used as a plot device many times. That was very similar to something that's being used in the current series, Torchwood, the Doctor Who spinoff. So it was interesting to see these things coming into play. They also had the cars that we mentioned, the shadow cars that had portable phones, much like cell phones, that were in them, and all sorts of gadgetry, and these big gull wing doors that would open automatically at the push of a button.
With the assistance of a stagehand.
Indeed. Apparently, some of the people involved in the production of the series actually started an automotive company and were planning to essentially sell shadow cars. You know, sell cars built on that same mold and that same form that you saw in the series. I don't know exactly what they were going to do to make the doors open. But they did actually found this company, and the company went under before they actually produced anything, but they had built the mold for producing these cars en masse. So that would have been interesting, but it didn't come to pass.
All right. We've talked about his earlier productions, Gerry Anderson. We'll just go through them briefly. His very famous puppet productions, which sort of went through the 1960s leading up to UFO. All of them science fiction. I think all of them, again, as Brian, you know, as you say, with that sort of American feel to them, despite being produced in Britain by his production team, Century 21 Productions. And it goes back to Supercar and Fireball XL5 And then there was his underwater one, Stingray, which is really where you get the sinking building thing for the first time, I think. And then his most famous one, of course, I think, is Thunderbirds, which I suspect most people know or have seen Thunderbirds at some point or other, with the international rescue protecting the world from disasters from Tracy Island. And again, we've got all sorts of buildings and bases and things sinking and rising, and these various ingenious ways of getting pilots into the various Thunderbird crafts through chutes and revolving doors and stuff like that, which was great fun. And he also went on to make a couple of other series just before he went on to UFO. He did Joe 90 and a show called The Secret Service, which were very much sort of spies and gadgetry. And again, I think we're coming off the back of James Bond and the success of James Bond in the 60s. And then a particular favourite of mine, Captain Scarlet. Very much science fiction, a battle between Earth and mysterious aliens called the Mysterons. I think we unwittingly get into a battle with the Mysterons. It's all a big misunderstanding, but it prompts this huge war. And one of the characters in Captain Scarlet was Captain Blue, who was voiced by Ed Bishop. And in fact, his puppet was the inspiration for the look of Commander Ed Straker in UFO.
That's the blonde wig.
Yes, that's right. The Captain Blue had the very blonde, almost white hair and blue eyes and a blue uniform. And so that's pretty much what they got Ed Straker to look like, as, you know, as played by Ed Bishop in both series. But they're all great fun. I mean, I'm a huge fan of those because they were a big part of my childhood watching Thunderbirds and Captain Scarlet.
Gerry Anderson is one of the few people that we can credit with basically creating his own genre or subgenre, because there were all of these Super Marionation shows that had really their own look to them. And through some of the model work, he carried over a lot of that look, certainly to UFO, and disputably perhaps to some of his later work as well.
He'd also, I think just before UFO, he had made a live-action movie, Gerry Anderson, or at least he'd been involved in a live-action movie called Doppelganger, although I think it's more commonly known in North America as Journey to the Far Side of the Sun, which, again, a science fiction show, a science fiction film about the discovery of a possible another Earth or another Earth-like planet on the other side of the sun. And I gather, if what I've read is correct, that the model work in it was not actually done by Gerry Anderson. He was just involved in the live action stuff.
Right. There was also a plan, and this didn't go through, but Gerry Anderson was set to write and produce the James Bond movie Moonraker. And Moonraker was the first Bond film to come out after Star Wars was released. That was really key to Moonraker because it was the Bond movie that went to space and involved space shuttles and all sorts of odd, much more science fiction type things as compared to what you'd usually have in a James Bond film. However, Moonraker was made and it was without Gerry Anderson's involvement.
Which is a shame because he might have made it better.
Perhaps.
Well, it'd been interesting to see a Gerry Anderson science fiction James Bond.
Yes, it would have.
We've also mentioned his wife, Sylvia, or his wife at the time, Sylvia Anderson, who was, you know, a big part of the production team, because she did all the costume work. She did the costumes for the puppets in the Super Marionation shows, and she did all the costumes for UFO, and partly gives it that distinctive look.
Wigs included.
Wigs included, yes, our favourite purple wigs, and all the other wigs, including Straker's blonde wig. And of course, you know, as I've mentioned, I'm particularly fond of Sylvia Anderson because she was the voice and the inspiration for the character of Lady Penelope in Thunderbirds.
There was actually a plan to make a follow-up series, a sequel series to UFO, that was to be called UFO 1999, and it was to be set on a larger version of the moon base. And in fact, there was an episode in UFO where they talked about building more moon bases or more parts to the moon base. In fact, they decided not to do that, and the project changed into an independent series, which was Space 1999, which was not based on UFO, and was in fact based in a world where the Earth had not encountered aliens, and Space 1999 started with this big calamity where a nuclear waste dump on the moon is ignited and there are multiple explosions, and the moon is torn out of Earth orbit. The entire series is basically the journey of the crew of Moonbase Alpha through space as the moon is traveling on its own through space. And that was an interesting series.
Yeah, it's an interesting show, Space 1999. He concentrated a bit more on the overall production and slightly less on some of the sort of model work for that. And it has it perhaps has a better outcome as a result.
UFO has a bit of the feel of a spectacle, you know, a visual spectacle of all these different things. And that was much less the case on Space 1999.
4,800 miles from impact. Speed? 24,000 knots. He'll never make it. We have it on ground radar.
So we should talk about the bits that work well in UFO and then some of the bits that don't work quite so well, although we've probably given some of that away already.
There were lots of interesting things they did. I did like some of the visual things they did with it. The model work sort of has its ups and downs. On one hand, when you see the models, sometimes you can see the strings holding them up, you know, the wires holding them up. Sometimes you can see them wobble a little bit. But at the same time, they were really dynamic looking. I think they looked more dynamic in how they moved than just about anything else from that time period or earlier. They had a couple of shots that you would see from time to time where a UFO was traveling across the surface of the moon and would go behind these little moon hills or moon mountains and go behind and come out the other side. And for its time, that looked very good.
As you can probably gather, I love the look of a UFO. I think it just looks fantastic. I'm not sure as to whether the model work is, you know, you could say, is it charming or is it childish? I just remember it as being so exciting to see this stuff on television, and I still find it quite charming to watch it now.
Yeah, it's a real mix. There are certain moments. There's one episode, and I think this was in the latter part of the series, where Sid itself is attacked. Sid is basically shot down. This is the satellite, the intruder detector. You see it partly exploding and then floating around off its proper orbit. And that didn't look like it was oriented towards kids. That just looked like good model work for its day.
Yes, that bit looks very good.
Things like Sky One launching off of Skydiver, and better still, Sky One breaking through the surface of the water, are pretty well executed. You know, it is a bit of an odd thing to have in there, and maybe oriented towards kids in some ways, but it looked pretty good. It looked relatively convincing.
Yeah, I did. I mean, when I watched it as a kid, it didn't bother me at all. It just looked great. I mean, now I watch it and I'm thinking, well, why have they got it underwater? Why didn't they just have it in the air?
Well, yeah.
Have it in the air in the first place?
And there were lots of things like that in there,
exactly.
For sure.
I mean, you mentioned that, you know, the SID satellite or the SID detector system breaking down or being attacked, and they have to go up and repair it. So who do they send up to repair it? Commander Ed Straker himself.
Jumping to the things that didn't work quite as well, and we'll come back to things that worked well for sure. There were a number of things like that where you had these very odd moments in the story or the plot that just didn't make that much sense, and they chose a lot of really ambitious adult-oriented topics, as we've mentioned, and they'd make a good start on those, and then the resolution of the story, in a lot of cases, was just not that satisfying, and that was too bad.
Yeah, I think that's a problem. You know, some of the episodes do rather peter out, and they don't seem to resolve the situation. And then by the next episode, it's all been forgotten, and then they're back to business as usual. And we do get that inconsistency that we've mentioned several times. Watching it now is rather bothersome. That, you know, I wish they'd had somebody taking an overview and saying, well, look, this doesn't fit in.
It seemed like the individual writers were left on their own, almost as if they had no script editor or no staff looking at them and saying, you know, well, let's take it from this odd thing that sort of works into something that has a better build-up and a better climax, or something that feels more like a UFO episode.
Exactly. I think you're right. I think that's what it needed. It needed a script editor to say, this doesn't fit the overall theme.
On the other hand, some of the issues and topics that they handled in UFO were ambitious. It was great to see them there. And in many ways, with those issues, they did a pretty good job, even if the story work didn't work as well as I'd like. There was one episode where they dealt with an alien who basically wanted to defect to Earth and to Shadow, and an encounter between that alien and a blind woman who didn't realize that this wasn't just a person who was for some reason not talking to her. That interaction with the alien and the blind person and the whole idea of the defector, that was pretty good.
Yeah, that was good, actually. I mean, as you say, we've got the alien, because he's trying to communicate and he's trying to come in from the cold, as it were. That was a good episode.
Those two or three times where they took the aliens and humanized them more and made them not just the bad guys out to get us, those were interesting.
Yeah, like the episode Survival that we mentioned with Paul Foster and the alien on the surface of the moon fighting to survive and having to work together. That was great as well. I thought it was a good episode. And then, of course, there's the Sub-Smash episode in the middle of the series with the submarine, which is a fantastic sort of tense 50 minutes of television.
The aliens travel in liquid in their spacesuits, and that was done visually quite well. They also, because of this, I believe, had these sort of shielding contact lenses that they wore. So the aliens had sort of all white eyes, and you would just see a pupil at the middle. There was a scene that was used in the opening title sequence of someone using a pair of forceps in this alien autopsy to remove that contact lens from the eye. And for its day, that was a very striking image.
That was very good. There is one other thing that stood out as a sort of problem I had with it, or a weakness, which is the sort of use of tobacco and alcohol in the series. It's very much of its time. Most of the characters smoke, and there's sort of fairly frequent visits to the drinks cabinet in Ed Straker's office, which is slightly unusual because I think we're told at one point that Straker had an alcohol problem and he doesn't drink himself anymore, I think is right. But all the other characters, certainly they drink, and they're forever lighting up.
Yes, in terms of the smoking, for sure. I think this had more than the typical series of its day. There was really a lot of that. I guess this was to get their sort of cool fashion show look, always relaxed and always drinking and smoking.
Yes, and it certainly stands out when we watch it now. I just think it does seem remarkable that all these characters lighting up all the time. And even, you know, when they're on Moonbase or when they're in submarines, they're still smoking.
Yeah, that was certainly very strange. The inconsistencies were more than just from before the production break to after the production break. Between different episodes after the production break, they would be inconsistent. And it was better before the production break, but still there were inconsistencies there. The acting, I felt, was sort of stilted in an odd way. Maybe this was because they were trying to transition from puppets to people, I don't know. But the acting and writing certainly had its moments. In many cases, I felt, didn't work as well as it should have.
Yeah, there's some of the tense episodes where the acting works really well. And then there's some other episodes where you think, goodness, they're just 6-foot puppets. If you watched British television in the 70s at all, you'll recognise loads of actors, loads of character actors turning up in UFO. Even some famous sort of film actors. I mean, quite remarkably, the actor and director Stephen Burkoff, who's now known for much more serious work, turns up as one of the interceptor pilots in a couple of episodes.
I think one of my favourite appearances was John Levine, who was Sergeant Benton with UNIT on Doctor Who for many years.
That's right.
And he was an interceptor pilot once as well.
So, availability of UFO, it is available on DVD in both Regions 1 and Regions 2. It's in Region 2, in sort of the UK and Europe, it's available in two different sets, 13 episodes in each set. But I think I'm right, in North America, it's one big mega set, as it's called, which contains all 26 episodes.
That's right. I think they did release it as two sets, and it was out that way for a while. But at this point, you will certainly find it as the mega set.
There's a few extra features on the DVDs. I think there's some commentaries from Gerry Anderson and Ed Bishop on a couple of episodes. And there's a lot of the sort of production stills and production notes.
So as for our recommendations, I would say that this is a fun show that has an out there, you know, late 60s Star Trek meets James Bond kind of look to it. And it takes a go at doing some pretty ambitious adult theme type ideas in there. If you are looking for something with lots of deep science fiction ideas and first-rate writing and acting, maybe this isn't what you want to watch. However, if you're looking for something that is fun with lots of wild visuals and out there stuff with aircraft flying out from underwater and moon bases and the purple wigs we've mentioned a number of times, it's a fun series. And if you look at it that way, then yeah, this might be worth checking out.
I think it's great fun. As you know, I enjoy it. I think this is was a good show, but it is quite different to a lot of the stuff we've discussed on British Invaders, and it is quite campy and rather distinctive to look at. And my recommendation would be, if you've never seen UFO, go to YouTube and search for UFO opening or UFO opening titles, and you'll be able to watch the opening sequence, and that will pretty much show you what we've been talking about, the look and feel of UFO. And you'll perhaps get an idea then if you wish to take your exploration of this series any further.
Yes, it certainly has its own look and its own feel, and this particular Gerry Anderson quality. So I think that wraps things up for our discussion of UFO. You can reach us at BritishInvaders@gmail.com, and you can find us at www.BritishInvaders.com. On the next episode of British Invaders, we will be talking about The Omega Factor, which was a 1979 supernatural series that dealt with investigations of various unexplained phenomena.
Spooky stuff.
Absolutely. So, this is Brian from Canada, signing off.
And until next time, this is Eamon from England saying goodbye, and keep watching the skies.